This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome, everyone, to Monday Match Analysis. I'm Gil Gross. Today's episode is a conversation with Abigail Johnson, where we preview each and every men's quarterfinal match at Roland Garros 2024, beginning with Wednesday's quarterfinals for maximum shelf life. Then we'll get to Tuesday's quarterfinals towards the end of the video. So it'll start with Djokovic-Ruud, Alcaraz-Tsitsipas after that, then Sinner-Dimitrov, then Dimonor Zverev. In hindsight, I should have flipped the last two, but too late for that. That is what we did. If you are only interested in hearing about one match and not the other, there will be chapters, there will be timestamps. Go into the description and toggle as you wish. Only other thing I will flag is that my audio in the first maybe 5 or 6 minutes was coming from the wrong microphone, so it probably doesn't sound great. If it annoys you so much that you're thinking about clicking off or going to something else, don't do that. Just skip ahead a couple minutes and my audio will be back to normal. So I wanted to say that. We'll get right to it with Abigail Johnson right after this. Right now, the world is watching one of the biggest tournaments in tennis. As the clay settles, the stakes rise at Roland Garros. Join Tennis Channel Plus in the heart of the action with daily live coverage of the second week at the French Open. Every point has the potential to be a historic moment in tennis history, and you never know when you're going to witness a match that will be talked about for years to come. So stream it now with Tennis Channel Plus to be there when it all goes down.
We're joined once again by prolific tennis commentator Abigail Johnson, who comes to us live from Surbiton for the grass court, beginning of the grass court season, after spending the first week last week at Roland Garros. So we appreciate you joining us, especially with your busy schedule. It's very late where you are, but I'm excited to get into these men's quarterfinal matchups. Thanks for coming on again.
Yeah, thanks. I'm sure my next door neighbor at the hotel does not appreciate it, but I'm going to speak at half volume. And look, I'm pumped to be here. It was a great week in Paris. I was doing radio, so we were dipping in and out of a lot of things. It's always quite a different vibe for radio, which I really enjoy. But yeah, my head is half in Surbiton, having already done first day there. So just so everyone's aware, Gil's going to be doing their heavy lifting here, and I'm going to be filling in the gaps. So that's
your
situation.
Your neighbor.
That is the situation.
The person in the room next to you is going to learn so much about the quarterfinal situation at Roland Garros. I'm sure, at first they might be annoyed, and then they'll be like, oh, she made a good point about Novak there, so it'll all be okay.
Yeah, it'll take the edge off.
Exactly. Just like whenever you're on site, I know at first there's a lot of buzz about what the tournament is looking like, and certainly on the men's side, we were swept up in this. Oh my God, it's so open. I mean, the top looks so vulnerable. There's feels like nobody's a good pick to win it. At what point did it feel like, oh, actually everybody's pretty good? Everybody looks great.
Round one. I mean, yeah, like you say, it was such an unusual field, knowing that Nadal is close to the end. Djokovic has been struggling all season. Injury concerns for Alcaraz and Sinner. Can Zverev step up in a big moment? Is Rune going to break through anytime soon? You've got story after story after story, haven't you? And that's where it was sat moving in. And from the moment Zverev did capitalize and take out Nadal, there was that real feeling of anything could happen here, including Djokovic rounding into form, which he has kind of threatened to do. So that's another interesting dimension to the whole situation. But by far the most intriguing men's Grand Slam in recent memory for me, if not ever, to be completely honest with you.
Yeah, in terms of the discourse coming in, certainly it was as hot as I can ever remember it being, which is really fun. But we end up with a quarterfinal lineup. I'm looking at the race right now, and I don't know what the result of this is going to be. But I think it's basically the entire quarterfinal lineup is top 10 in the race. Is that possible? It's most so Rublev, no, and Medvedev, no. But other than that, it's the top 10 in the race. So the players who have performed in 2024 as a whole have performed here at Roland Garros. We're going to get into all four of those quarterfinals. We're going to go backwards just so the ones with the most shelf life are going to be at the top. And then, for example, I think, does Sinner have the first match tomorrow? I think he may against Dimitrov. That'll be at the end. So Djokovic, Rude, let's start there. And we'll hit on the fourth round matches a little bit as well for Novak. Five setter against Cirundolo. And now it's two in a row where there have been moments in the match where it looks like Novak is certainly in a disadvantageous position, pretty up and down performances. And I think the headline here, Abigail, is he relies in both these matches on this massive clutch advantage.
Yeah, look, in any other year, I would not be surprised at all at this by Novak Djokovic, because it's the bank of experience. It's what he does, right? And it's what he has done for many, many seasons. With the concerns about his general form coming into the tournament and where he was at physically with the incident in Rome when attacked by Bottle, when, you know, having gone to Geneva and felt the need to play the week before a slam for the first time in a long time to gather form. There were a lot of genuine question marks. This was the first season we've come into where I had genuine questions about how close to the end Djokovic himself might be on a physical level, on a mental level, all of the above. And so for him to still be able to draw upon that history and maintain that mental edge, even when physically he has been clearly flagging in patches, that speaks so strongly as to what history can do. I feel like as commentators, as people who work in the sport, it can be a default thing to draw on at times. And yet, in the best of five Grand Slam scenario, is still such a factor.
One of his greatest superpowers is he actually can get better in when the tension is at its highest. He can play a better level. And I think 99% of tennis players, it's not the case. They get worse. Let's go to Casper Ruud, though, and then we'll get to the prediction and we can go back to Novak. I feel like the word for me is reliability. Hasn't had quick matches, hasn't come close to losing either. If you look at his season as a whole and just how these matches have gone, somewhat how you would expect them to go, just feels like you know what you're going to get from Casper. And that's what has stood out to me.
Yeah, he's steady Eddie, Casper Ruud, isn't he? And I rewind to 12 months ago. And I'm always going to be so careful with this guy now, because he's a back-to-back finalist here. And this time last year, with the form he had leading up to the event, I thought, okay, well, he can claw his way into the tournament. But I distinctly remember having the thought, he's not making final this year, which he then only went and did. Not just doing that, but also taking out Holger Rune, Alexander Zverev back-to-back to do so. So for him, I don't think it matters too much that he's dropped a set here and there. It's problem solving. It's time on court. It's picking up the confidence of being able to navigate those situations. He's a guy who knows that he can play on all of these different surfaces on the different courts at this venue. He's amassing that security for himself that comes through in the bigger moments. We know what the forehand does. It's the heaviest on the tour. It is something that he can lean on when he needs to. I'm just really careful now where Ruud is concerned, because I feel like I've I never fully write anyone off, but I've definitely come close to it with Ruud at times, with moments where he struggled for big wins and big situations.
Yeah, no, I think that's well put. And then unfortunately last year he kind of went back to where he was in the lead up to Roland Garros, post Roland Garros, which had me a little bit disappointed. This year, on the contrary, week in and week out, he's there. I mean, he's made hard court finals, he's made clay court finals. He had a little back issue against Kecmanovic in Rome and lost early, but that's like the only blip in the radar. So I think when you look at this quarterfinal, it's a guy in Djokovic who we know has a higher ceiling than Casper Ruud, and we know at his best has an untouchable level against Casper Ruud. But you also have someone in Ruud who has been ultra reliable, and someone in Djokovic who has shown many different shades of tennis. And on the full spectrum of 0 to 10, we've seen 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and 10. So, should we talk about the withdrawal possibility or get right to the mat? Let's cover the withdrawal possibility. There's the knee thing for Djokovic. And I mean, you're not 100% at this point. He's not 100% that he's going to play the quarterfinal. And I put it at like maybe 10% he withdraws if I were to just kind of, obviously, it's speculation, but that's what I'm feeling.
Yeah, it goes the lower side of 50 to be sure, because it's such a big event. And as well, Djokovic has spoken so much about how the Olympics are a big goal. So really, he wants as much court time at this tournament as possible. I think the difference here in mentality is, look, he went into the Francisco Cerúndolo match knowing that he could win it without his best level and without his peak physicality, because he's up against a guy with A, less experience by a long shot, and B, I mean, I was in the house for half of his match against Lorenzo Musetti, and the appreciation you have for what Musetti does on a tennis court when he's feeling it is five times in person what it would be watching on a screen. Because on a screen, things can get a little mono. You don't see the slight differences in touch and in switch up the same way you would see it in the flesh. And from my perspective, for the most part of the second set and the third set, Musetti pretty much played a flawless match in terms of the constant switch up on the ball, answering Djokovic's genius with sublime responses, and just generally being very disciplined with a very intricate brand of tennis that he was bringing to the court. And Djokovic still won that match. And that's He's the master of pacing. And I thought, if Djokovic is beating Musetti in this match, even if it is a case of Musetti having peaked too early, I just don't see how Cerúndolo is going to deal the knockout blow, even if he's struggling to recover. Because as much as Cerúndolo is a great clay court player, I didn't see that depth of skill set, or that confidence that Musetti had from having wins over Djokovic in the past and doing well against him at this venue, to actually step up and get across the line. I mean, I was on the call in Surbiton. I came off end of the fourth set, and the first thing I saw was Cerúndolo rolling forehands. He can hit that forehand,
Yeah.
but he was missing what is for him a basic shot in big moments. And there were other people. It was the Players Cafe, and there were other people there, and there was another guy there, and he would kind of turn every time Cerúndolo hit a good shot, and he said, "Oh, I hit that one." And I'd say, "Yeah, but he's down on the scoreboard at this point." It was when Djokovic was back in it, or it was when there was less on the line. So that's all a long-winded way of saying I think Djokovic knew that he could play at 60% in that match, or lower than that, and still sneak through it. Casper Ruud, who now has a win over him and has experience playing him at this event, is a different story. So would he go out there in the same condition that he was in playing that Cerúndolo match? That's the million-dollar question. And honestly, I don't know the answer to it, because I don't know what shape his body is in.
Right. You have to account for the Djokovic level raise because it's so easy. And we've fallen into this trap before, or plenty of people have. I know I have, of copy and pasting the level from a previous round and say, oh, well, if he plays like that, Ruud's going to beat him. It's like, well, yeah, okay. But he might not play like that. He might play better. For me, it's this. There's the mystique of greatness with Novak and now this air of invincibility that's almost been reinforced by the last two matches where it's looked like he's in trouble and then he wasn't, versus logic. So the mystique of greatness versus logic, and I'm the kind of guy who has trouble getting past the logic. And I feel like physically this is going to be a bridge too far. Rude is not going to beat himself. He will continue going after his forehand no matter what the scoreboard says. He's not going to get overwhelmed by the moment. I don't think he has so much experience at this point. I've seen his level getting better and better in big matches. And he's not going to get discouraged easily either. He's a tenacious fighter. He's built up the experience in these big matches. I feel like he's played better and better in these kinds of matches as the years have gone on. I've seen that very clearly. He's going to keep going after his forehand. It doesn't matter what the score says. So physically, I think it will end up being a bridge too far for Djokovic. And I pick Ruud in five.
We're doing sets. It's been a long time since I've done this with you, Gil. I kind of forgot we were doing sets.
So we're doing sets, but I usually go off of confidence, not meaning five means I could, it's tough pick for me. Four okay. means I feel confident in my pick, but I do see the other player with paths to victory. Three is I would really be surprised if it wasn't this way.
I love that. I rate that there's a scale there for each one. You know what? This was going to be, I thought this was going to be my huge punt, this one, because I kind of have an idea of the direction I'm going with the other ones. You summed it up brilliantly. It's really difficult to make this call when you don't fully know what you're working with. Did Djokovic feel like he could bring a lesser level to Cerundolo? Did he have even more in the tank there if it was required that he didn't actually put out on court on the day? There are so many unknowns. I didn't have Djokovic as the lead contender coming in this time around. I've been quite vocal in that I sensed a change in him from the very end of last year, transitioning into the beginning of this year. And I know he's had setbacks and illnesses and injuries, but that is a fact. And that is part of the passing of time. It's actually incredible that he's avoided those kinds of blips for so long. If there was ever a time to take a punt against him, which I rarely, if ever, do at this stage of a Grand Slam, for all the reasons mentioned above, this is it. And I did say that I didn't want to play Casper Ruud down again. I kind of feel it would be disrespectful to him not to give him the shot here with his form and with Djokovic's question marks. So with no amount of confidence, meaning that I'll probably join you at the five sets, okay, I'll say Casper Ruud. But you know, I looked at that draw for Djokovic when it came out. I saw his opening rounds, chance to play himself into the event. And I messaged someone I've been talking to it about and said, look, his title chances just skyrocketed there. I'd kind of not had him in contention prior to that.
Excellent draw first two rounds, which was very helpful. Yeah. And by the way, pre-tournament, this was my pick. I always have a slight bias towards just keeping whatever I had, but it really was the same thing coming into the tournament. I was in the same position looking at what Ruud has done throughout the year versus what Djokovic has done throughout the year. And obviously, if those two things are in the same vicinity, it's like edge Djokovic by a mile. They're not in the same vicinity. It's Casper by 2x. And has, from what I've seen this tournament so far, do I change my mind? Despite Djokovic showing a ton of heart, a ton of resolve, which is something that I actually really wanted to see from him at this tournament, and I think bodes well for the rest of the year. Despite that, no. What I've seen from both players hasn't changed my mind on where I was at pre-tournament. And ultimately, I think physically that's the main thing, though. I just think it's a bridge too far. Let's go to Alcaraz versus Tsitsipas. I don't want to go as much into their fourth round.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Matches, I don't think it's necessary to do. So let's just go right into the head-to-head. Unless there's something that you're dying to say about one of their fourth round matches where Tsitsipas took out Arnaldi in four sets and Alcaraz, I'm actually blanking.
One-sided Felix Auger-Aliassime.
Right.
I think I was in transit, Gil, for both of those matches, to be completely honest with you, and only caught up with them at the other end. But nothing hugely surprising, to be honest. Not surprised that Alcaraz rolled Auger-Aliassime. Not surprised that Tsitsipas dropped a set. I feel like that's fairly reflective of where both of them are at in those specific matchups. And yeah, I think that's as much as I would say on the surface level.
Okay, so it's a 5-0 head-to-head for Alcaraz, one of the most famous head-to-heads in tennis, if I do say so myself, famously one-sided. It's one of those head-to-heads that any casual fan could almost rattle off by memory because of that. And what has struck me about it is it's gone one direction the whole time, which is more and more in favor of Alcaraz. If you look at total points won percentage by match, 2021 US Open, first time they played, Tsitsipas actually won more points, over 50%. In Miami, 2022, Tsitsipas won 45%. Barcelona, it was 44. So these are the first three are actually all really good, close, competitive matches. And then you get Barcelona 2023, which was 41.6%. That's kind of blowout territory. And then last year at Roland Garros, mega blowout territory, 40% points won in the match for Tsitsipas. So worse every time. What's your reaction to that? I'm just going to leave it there.
I remember last year when they played at Roland Garros, and I was desperately trying to get over the idea that it was a straightforward straight sets win for Alcaraz. I don't like to make those hard and fast decisions before a point is even being played, but just because of the way the head-to-head had gone, not just in terms of results, but as you say, the way those results had played out, it was very difficult with the form Alcaraz was in this time last year, in these conditions, gaining on the clay, and Tsitsipas struggling to see it going any other way. And I'm not convinced a huge amount has changed on Tsitsipas' side of the net. I think more has changed on an Alcaraz front, because a year ago, for a period of months, he looked like this, I don't want to say unbeatable, but there was a scary patch for Alcaraz when he was coming through 2022, beginning of 2023, almost kind of leading up to Wimbledon. It took cramps and incredible tennis from Djokovic to stop him in last year's semifinals. And the thing for me, Gil, with this head-to-head is I remember that first ever meeting, the US Open match. It really stayed with me. And I thought, God, if Alcaraz can come up with these responses in these kinds of pressure moments against Tsitsipas now with the ranking that he's at? He was way down the rankings compared to where he is now at that point. How is Tsitsipas going to find it when he's a better and more improved player with more behind him to lean into, with more experience in the matchup as well? I just feel like if the two of them, Alcaraz has that higher ceiling and is still in a better place. I don't want to discredit Tsitsipas, but I felt like that Monte Carlo title for him was a bit of a red herring. I mean, he was one iffy line call away from being out to Jannik Sinner in the semifinals, that double fault that wasn't called, via which he would have been a double breakdown in the final set, which is very well known. He needed that. I'm glad for him that he got that, but it was a venue. As a clay court, it plays very differently to other venues, Monte Carlo, and the vibe there for him, the history behind him, it just made it a very different setting. I kind of don't bring anything that happened there into consideration in this tournament and in this particular matchup, which is a very long-winded way of saying, once again, that I kind of know where I'm sitting here.
Okay, okay.
I wonder whether you do as well.
So, look, you're right. I think the idea that Monte Carlo is just a different place for Tsitsipas, it's a compelling idea. I mean, it's his three big titles. They're all in one place. That tells you something. But he did have a lot of good wins other than Sinner, which I agree. You kind of put an asterisk next to that win to a certain extent, which is very rare in tennis that you can say that. But it was that crucial and pivotal. The Tsitsipas spin for the head-to-head, I just want to throw out there. If you are Stefanos Tsitsipas's lawyer, you say their first three matches were really great contests. Close, pretty even. Alcaraz just won them. The next two were last year when he just wasn't right. Like, Steph's game wasn't right after the Australian Open. It was never good mentally, coaching-wise. And then, like, the Roland Garros thing, he was a zombie in that match. And he said, well, I accidentally took a melatonin and because I was trying to nap and I just didn't have any energy. So if you're Tsitsipas's lawyer, that's the spin. Now, before the tournament, Abigail, because of kind of the same thing you said, which is Alcaraz's reliability feels a little bit lower than what it was when he was white hot first half of last year, I decided to, I actually picked Tsitsipas in the quarterfinal. Now, some of it was, I trust Tsitsipas to make it to the quarters more than Alcaraz. I was really worried about the forearm, not just the overall form. I was really worried about the forearm because hitting arm injuries to me are super scary because they linger in your mind. Even when they get better, they still linger in your mind. So that's where I was at the time. Before I tell you my pick, I want to get your response to this take. Tsitsipas is too good on clay to let this trend continue. Like, it can't get worse. He needs to start at least being competitive in this matchup because the distance, regardless of what the tactics are, and we can talk about that, the distance between the two players is not enough for this to be a Djokovic versus Monfils head-to-head, you know, 10 years down the road.
But this was my line of thinking 12 months ago when I was trying to reason with myself that it would not be straight sets Alcaraz. I was genuinely going down this path of thinking because it's always when it gets to about 4-love and 5-love, when you have two players of that kind of top 10 quality that you think surely not, when they're both sustaining that kind of ranking. It's a really tough one, Gil. You know what? I actually defaulted to Alcaraz as my pick to win the tournament. And it was pure default by process of elimination of other players. I wouldn't have come up to you and said, I just feel that based on his level and his progression, I think Alcaraz is going to win Roland Garros. It was more situational things for Djokovic, Sinner not having peaked on clay yet, Nadal being on his way out, Zverev not having converted championship point at a Grand Slam. It was minuses on the other sides. I'm not convinced by Alcaraz level at the moment. It might be a poor take from me, but I was quite surprised. I sat doing reporting on his match against Sebastian Korda, and I think this is where, when you've prepped for a specific match, it really helps because you know the backstory. And Korda's not found his footing since getting that, I think it was the wrist injury at the beginning of last season. And
yes,
I think it's been a long road back for him mentally as much as anything else, and regaining that kind of Australian Open 2023 form that he had where he beat Medvedev. And it showed for me in that match with Alcaraz. I think there was definitely a bit of a veil over it because of the quality of some of the rallies. And Alcaraz did come up with some screamers, as he always does. But to get broken at a pivotal moment of the set, two loose forehands from Korda, you know, tiebreak, Alcaraz was pretty fortunate to win it, having, I think he let a bit of a lead slip and he converted on the return for 7-5. And then he went on to court, and Fabrice Santoro, I think, was interviewing him and said, "Oh, Carlos, what a great match." And Alcaraz was beaming and he said, "Yeah, he played really well." And I'm happy for him for sure. But I don't know if that was me having picked him for the title, weighing him up against the level I would expect of him as a title contender. But it didn't convince me what I'd seen. But if it convinced Alcaraz, that makes all the difference, because throughout the last few years, he's a player who has responded to confidence. And if he's confident in how he's playing and has never had a bad loss at this tournament, by the way, Jan Leonard Struff, 2021, Alexander Zverev, 2022, Novak Djokovic, 2023.
He hasn't had a bad loss. Yeah, I just want to jump in and say he hasn't had a bad loss at a major since breaking into the top 10. It hasn't happened. His worst loss is against Sinner at Wimbledon, who is ranked 13 at the time. On a grass court. And he's never, he had like never played on grass. So that's not a bad loss, but that's his worst loss by ranking. So he's been very consistent in the early rounds. It's interesting because I have been pleased with his level, but I'm the opposite of you. Like, my expectations were really low. I was very concerned about his forehand. And at first I didn't see him bludgeoning the forehand, but it actually looked kind of nice. Like, he was almost more responsible with it, more tactical with it. And then I think as the tournament has progressed, he started to kind of mix the more higher, spinnier, softer, angled stuff with the Mach 8 flat bone crushers. And I'm actually pretty pleased with the level, but that is funny because we kind of came in from different angles. I'm so pleased with my level that I can't really stick with my pick. This is one that I chose, you know, I picked Tsitsipas based on Alcaraz not being at the peak of his capabilities and the belief that Tsitsipas was just too good on clay to keep getting blown out by someone. But the Alcaraz part of that has shifted for me. He's shown me enough where I do think that he'll basically find a way to be ruthless and consistent enough to exploit Tsitsipas's backhand in the baseline rallies. And we could get into the detail of how he does that or not, I don't know, but it seems to be a simplified version of what he's able to do. I mean, Tsitsipas's backhand hasn't been able to hang against Alcaraz, not just in the sense that he can't make it or that Alcaraz hits a forehand at Tsitsipas's backhand and Tsitsipas can't make it in the court. It's that he can't remain unattackable. He can't protect it because it takes so much when you're hitting a cross court backhand against Alcaraz. It better be good or you're going to get killed. And for Tsitsipas, not only sometimes do you get the misses, you get the short balls, you get the central balls too much. And that's what kind of kills him.
Yeah, I don't have much to add to that. I feel like Alcaraz is one of those players that can expose the one-hander, and that has been reflected across the course of the journey to date. And was that your official prediction? I didn't hear any sets from you on that.
Four. Thank you for keeping me in check.
You're welcome. I have to back the guy that I very nervously said was going to win the thing. Luke Tsitsipas, he's performed here. He two sets to love up on Djokovic in the final in 2021. He has the game to utilize this surface. I just wouldn't call him to do it in this match. So I'd say Alcaraz in four sets. I'm scarily similar to you so far, but I'm quite happy about that with your track record, to be honest. I'm feeling pretty good right now at 20-2 in the morning. So
it's been a good predictions tournament for me so far. So I don't know what that means going forward. I nervously picked Jannik Sinner to win the tournament. Some people might not think it was nervously because then I felt like he wasn't getting any respect and I kind of went on the offensive on my show and I was like, what the heck? Like, and I was making a case very passionately for Sinner at that point, but it was nervously. If you go back, it actually was nervously despite what people might think. He hasn't had good preparation. He talked about being ill for a while. He had the hip. He said he's had 9 days. Is there anything you've seen that concerns you real quick before we get to his opponent, Grigor?
Honestly, no. Okay. I remember tuning into his first round match. And first of all, the first immediate thing I'm looking for is how well is he moving with the hip concerns. Looked like he was moving great to me, fluidly. Just a very sharp read of the ball, watching that ball and giving himself time. And yeah, it was good stuff. And I know there was a lot of kind of shockwaves about the manner in which he lost the first set to Karenson, first set to Karenson Mute yesterday. And, you know, the two points against him for the first bagel set he'd lost since 2021, which is a crazy stat, by the way, absolutely crazy stat. But to me, he was in a position there where, look, it's early days. Mute, right. he's a guy with flair, and playing to an audience at that point in time, and he has serious hand skills, which he showed off to the max, and he kind of spent most of his tank in that first set, and Sinner had the cool to let that wash around him, roll off his back, and move on. So no real concerns based on any, and I wouldn't say I had any level of expectation for him really coming in, because Sinner on clay remains a little bit of an unknown compared to where he sits on the hard courts, for example, and, you know, had a good run at Wimbledon last year. But so far, so good. Very, very technical take from me, but so far, so good.
I'm with you. No, I mean, look, he comes out against Mute. All of his shots are landing short. He's not making any first serves. And Mute was either swinging out of his shoes on a forehand and putting it in the corner or hitting a perfect drop shot. It's like, okay, you know, whatever. And then once Sinner actually started hitting his ball with good length and the power that he is so known for, it's like, try drop shotting that. And that's basically how it went. There's a little physical wobble at the end of the Gaz K match. Anybody who just looked at the scoreline of the Gaz K match was like, oh, that was really simple. Anyone who watched, I think, was like, oh, that kind of got a little bit scary. But so that was weird. I don't know what that was, but I think it's past him. No concerns with Sinner. As for Dimitrov, huge accomplishment for him. He's now made the quarterfinals at all four slams. But then it's been pointed out since that it's not just the slams. He's made the quarters at all big tournaments. Like, you can throw every Masters 1000 in there and he's made the quarters. As far as his clay game is concerned, for me, it hasn't changed at all. It's exactly what he was doing on the hard courts in the last 6 months. There's a lot of first serve forehand dominance, but there's also a pretty good plan B to fall back on in the baseline rallies, which is like, he still has that athleticism. It hasn't gone away at all at, I think, 32 years old. So, you know, I don't think he's changed anything to make his first Roland Garros quarterfinal. I think it's the same thing that we were seeing all year long when he was on the hard courts.
I'm pretty much in the same boat as you as far as that goes with Dimitrov. I just want to say I'm so impressed with him this season. Straight out of the gates, Brisbane, making that final against Rune there and just playing the level that reminded you why he was so hyped, and he was hyped back in the day. To see him transfer it to clay is the most impressive thing to me because, well, no, not necessarily to clay because he didn't have a spellbinding clay season leading in, but to bring it to best of five sets at Roland Garros, round of applause, because it's a textbook as far as the surface goes. You wouldn't pick him as talented as he is, as much of a skill level as he has. Just coming into this specific match, look, the way you say about transferring across the board, the issues for Dimitrov will always transfer across the board for me. And that is the fact that I feel like he will have lapses in focus that are more exposed in a longer format and a longer tournament where you have to sustain. Like even watching him in Brisbane with his level there, I was actually sat with a former coach of his watching one of his matches and, great level. And then a couple of points and it's like, where did that come from? Well, it's Dimitrov. So it's what happened, right? And I don't know if that's personality or a habit or whatever that is, but I expect it to crop up at some point, whatever the tournament. The most interesting part of this potential, this match for me is that Dimitrov has not played on court Philippe Chatrier in hot day conditions yet. I believe they have the day match and the sun should be out. I dare not predict it, having almost drowned in Paris last week, but the sun should be out on the court. And I feel like this hasn't really been spoken about. Maybe I've been living under a rock, but I've not heard it spoken about the number of matches that a lot of these guys have played on Chatrier compared to others in the draw. And it's well known that the stadium courts at Roland Garros play differently. Dimitrov's played half a match against Zizou Bergs on Philippe Chatrier. It was damp and the roof was closed, and that was the only time he lost a set. So that's just an interesting dimension of this match for me against a player in Sinner who's pretty much been on that court every single time. And it's a brand new situation for Dimitrov. As you say, he's just completed an incredible set of quarterfinals. Massive respect to him. I do wonder if that factor comes into play in this match.
I think it was one of the women said, everyone else is playing one tournament and then there's a different tournament in here, referring to Chatrier. Do you remember
who
said
missed that?
I missed
that comment, but that is like, I hear that 100%. I hear that.
Faster, slower, or just different?
Longlin, I think, is often been said that Longlin is quicker than Chatrier.
Okay.
I'm not sure of the impact of the roofs, plural, and thank goodness they had those roofs this year, because I'm telling you, if they did not, they would be around, if not more, behind in the singles. The doubles is already scuppered. Forget the doubles, but the singles would be, a full round behind at this stage. I'm not convinced it has as much impact as... I mean, it's not a full kind of secured roof at the sides on Longlin, for example, the texture of that roof.
My observation has been Chatrier, when the roof is closed, slows down a ton. And it seems like it gets really humid in there as well. Some of the slowest matches that I feel like I've watched on Chatrier, and it's hard to use the eye test, has been roof closed.
But it's interesting. Chatrier was pretty cool the times I went in. I would say Roland Garros in general gets very cool beyond a certain time of day. I don't roof open, roof closed. When it hits, 8 p.m., 9 p.m. in the evening, it's cold from there on out. Doesn't matter how many people are in the stadium or whether the roof is on or off. That's just the way it plays out. I've not hit on any of these courts. Like, I go by word of mouth and whatever eyesight I can muster on this front. But yeah, I just feel like he's going to have to work the points differently if the roof is open and the sun is shining.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting point. And in terms of height of bounce, if it's super lively, I don't think his backhand loves that. I don't think his backhand slice loves that. So that's an interesting part of it. The head-to-head is 3-1 Sinner. Jannik has won the last three, so Dimitrov kind of beat Sinner early on. It was 2020. It's obviously a Miami Open final rematch. Sinner was spectacular in that final, but he won, I believe, either 4-2 or 2-4. And what I kind of noticed in that match was that Sinner was taking a lot of Dimitrov's biggest and best punches. The serve plus one stuff that Grigor was blowing everybody away with all week long in Miami, Jannik neutralized it. And there were even a lot of offensive positions, like Dimitrov would get attacking forehands. He should win 80% of the points because of how dynamic he is when he has an attacking forehand. And it felt like against Sinner, that was down to 50. And Jannik was actually able to stay in the points. And my thing is on clay, you can almost times that by two. Like if Dimitrov couldn't really break through with his firepower on Miami quick hard courts, I imagine it doesn't get better on clay. I can't get that out of my head when it comes to this match.
Hugely valid. And going back to how well Sinner has been moving this tournament. Now, I wasn't so much aware of the Gasquet thing. The thing with when you're covering radio is you're in this match, and when you're in the match, you're in it, but then you're out and you're into another match. So you do end up missing things. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't fully aware of kind of the physical situation with Gasquet there. So that's a point of interest, but obviously has come through another match since then unscathed. And just looking at the players Dimitrov has come through, I don't think they match the all-round skill level plus form of Jannik Sinner. And his path up to Roland Garros this season, in the clay court tournaments he's played, he's lost every time he's come up against a name, in inverted mm-hmm. commas. Like, it's a very lazy way of me to put it, which I will allow myself at this hour of the morning. But you know what I'm saying. You know, the first time he comes up against a matchup that he's not necessarily expected to win outright, he has lost. So, yeah, I just think that even if there's a surface change here compared to the form that he had across the back end of last season, beginning of this, Sinner is a step up. And I expect him to maintain and build on that head-to-head advantage.
I got Sinner in four.
Yeah, uh-oh. I think a lot hinges on the opening set. And mm-hmm. if he gets that first set, Sinner, it could be a three-set job. But I hate to say that because I can actually make an argument for Dimitrov in this match. But I also feel like I've told myself, like, when I used to do these predictions, by the way, remember I was a YouTuber once, and I would beat around the bush so much because I always would reason for every player. Like, if you get to this point, there's an argument for you being able to come through, right? That's just the way it is. But I always told myself, when I come back to it, you know, be a bit more ruthless with it, kind of reason and then back yourself. And I think if Sinner can start quick, as he did not against Mute, so that was okay, you've had your warning.
Mm-hmm.
There is potential there. And I think the only win that Dimitrov got in their head-to-head was on clay, correct? In Rome a few years ago.
Yeah.
I think it was Rome 2020. And that was three sets. And that was Sinner in the very early stages. So if that was three sets, and yeah, granted, Dimitrov's not at the level he is now. I feel like I'm just trying to talk myself up to calling Sinner and straights here.
I'm closer to three than five. So okay. I like it. I like your pick. If you do that, I fully support it.
I appreciate that. I think that's enough for me to nail it down. I mean, look, everyone in the comments, you can fully come and nail me when Dimitrov wins in four or whatever happens, but yeah, I think I'll back that with Sinner. I think I'll say Sinner and straights. Tight straights, though. You've got a couple of tight sets in there for sure.
No doubt. All right, last one. Demonor versus Zverev. We just watched. I mean, we hit the record button right after Zverev won in five over Holger Rune. Demonor earlier today beating Daniil Medvedev. All right, so Zverev leads the head 7-2.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ooh, I think once again, we go to the physical thing. It's a similar conversation that we had with Novak in some ways, because I do think Zverev is a time bomb now. And we saw this in Australia. He went 5 with Lucas Klein. He went 5 with Cam Nouri. And then he went 5 with Medvedev. And in the fifth, done. Nothing left. So it feels like it's trending that direction again for Zverev. And it's just part of playing slams and going deep is not getting yourself into too many of these. And some look, Holger Rune, incredible player. Sometimes they're unavoidable. But to me, Zverev is a time bomb now. I just don't know when it explodes. You know what I mean?
I do. And I think it's an interesting take. I feel like we've been in agreement a lot on this one. I might take a more alternative viewpoint just here. I think when I was on the call for Zverev Medvedev AO baseline, oh my goodness, best comms view in the world from that bunker. It, just unbelievable. And it was my birthday as well. And that ended my birthday. It was just a dream. But I kind of felt Zverev fading in that match was more mentally manifesting itself physically rather than I've got nothing left in my legs. I mean, let's not forget how close he was to that win. He was 2 points away. He had a serve for it. And then Medvedev, by his and his team's admission, got a little lucky with the dead net cord return there. And you could just see Zverev's shoulders droop and he bit his lip at that point. And it was, you knew it was going to be a mountain for him to climb from there. That said, I mean, these roadblocks,
you're saying Zverev is such a beast physically that he can actually withstand playing a ton of five setters and hold up at least the leg standpoint. So I also think his endurance and his durability is amazing. I just think there's a line
there. Sure. Yeah. I would agree. I think that's the case for every player, but there's an interesting thing when it comes to Zverev. Okay. You know how there's two kinds of cramps. So yes, you can cramp due to conditions or you can cramp because you're nervous. I think with Zverev, there are two kinds of passive. There is a passive when the biggest achievement is on the line and it's suddenly real for him, like in the when he was two sets to love up on Medvedev in that Australian Open semifinal, like when he was two sets to love up on Dominic Thiem in the 2020 US Open final. So there's that passive, but there's also the passive that he's exhibited at times in many early rounds of slams. I think at moments against Holger Rune tonight, you know, I didn't say it in text because I didn't want to jinx the time of this recording, but my instinct going into that was Zverev in five, just because he likes a little, and taking no credit away from Holger Rune, I'm a big fan. I think he's got so much in his game and so much more to come, but Zverev is a three-time straight semi-finalist here, and going back to this thing of the two kinds of passive, look, there, he's known for starting slow in majors. And very rarely, by the way, does he lose first round or second round of a major. But he comes into this year's Roland Garros and he beats Rafael Nadal, 14-time champion at the event, in straights. What is that? When often he's going four sets, five sets at the beginning. This is Zverev knowing that that is what is required of him on that given day. No passive today. I step up, I hit the ball, I play my game, I'm done. And I just feel like there's a subconscious in him that registers when he can allow himself to be that other player, the one that will stay out there for a little bit longer, that will do things the hard way, that will miss that stretch volley wide against Rune to go through a fifth set. You know what I'm saying? it is a very interesting element of him that I just have felt about him over the years. There's a reason this guy had won 3 Masters 1000s titles by the age of 21 or whatever it was. He knows when he needs to be there. He just hasn't figured it out at the very biggest tournaments at the Grand Slams because of that other passive that comes when your body seizes up because you're scared to cross that line. I think Nadal called it the fear of winning. That's what that is.
And
thus
you think,
ends my essay.
Okay. No, it's a very nuanced perspective, and therefore it's not the easiest to absorb, but we're gonna do it. So you're saying that when he can sometimes play down a level because he doesn't have the desperation of knowing that he needs to bring his 10 out of 10. So against Nadal, he very much knew he needed to bring his 10 out of 10. But against Griekspoor, heavy favorite, doesn't necessarily need it, played with his food a little bit.
You just said what I said in 5 minutes and 20 seconds.
I had the advantage. I had the advantage of hearing you say it. So what does that mean? Okay, well,
for the lovers of the English language, you had me. For the lovers of the statistical straightforward, you had Gil. That's what I'm here for, you know.
All right, so let's get to Demonor. We're going to circle back to the two passives theory. Demonor beat Medvedev. They always struggle to hit through each other. Now you bring Clay into the mix; they're really going to struggle to hit through each other. Demon served the best I've ever seen him serve. Full stop. He was more reliable than Medvedev on his attacking forehand. He's a little bit better, more natural taking the ball early, coming forward. So in a match where like you just needed something extra to create offense, Demonor had it, Medvedev didn't. There was a medical timeout for Medvedev that seemed to turn the match. I just didn't see an injury, so I don't really know what to make of that. And I can leave it at that. I'll either let you respond to that or we can talk about Demonor versus Zverev, and you can give your opening thoughts. Up to you.
I was on the call in Surbiton during this match, so I barely saw a point. So I will keep my words to a minimum. I did not have Daniil Medvedev. As much as I am a massive appreciator of the Medvedev, I did not have him up there with the title contenders coming into this tournament for obvious reasons. He's not won a title in a year, let alone on a clay court, which is his least preferred surface. So yeah, I think with them having had some tight battles in the past and Demonor really ramping it up and building a level throughout this season, it was going to be a fair prediction for Demonor to come through that match in whatever number of sets.
Yeah, the funny thing is Demon, until this year, he also had far inferior results on clay compared to hard and grass, but he's gotten stronger. His weight of shot is up. He's got a lot of confidence. There are some qualities of his game that are great for clay, but he's almost like in the Dimitrov camp. He's brought the hard court stuff over to Roland Garros. And I feel like both of them are in that category of players who you kind of dock points for on the clay, but they've done great here. The head to head is very Zverev favored, 7-2. This is actually a pretty tough one for me to decide. It's one of my more fuzzy headed things because I do feel like Zverev, what Zverev did in Rome, what Zverev did against Nadal in the first round, haven't seen it last two rounds. Like I've seen moments of it. I've seen blips, but I've also seen shakiness, nerve management issues. Now you bring the physicality concerns into effect. Then again, I'm not very quick to pick Demonor because I've seen how this matchup has gone. And I do think Zverev has a lot to like about him over Alex in this matchup. I want to hear what you have to say. We'll see if you swing me one way or the other. I do have a pick, but let's go to you first.
Yeah, as do I. I think I firstly want to say that I'm so impressed with Alex Demonor. I did not think he was going to develop as a player the way he has. I genuinely thought that there was a pretty solid ceiling there that was going to freeze him at around the top 15, he's a prime example of backing yourself and being your own best friend and biggest supporter and digging beyond the bottom of the hole. Like he's, you mentioned his, you know, his weight of shot and his movement has always been there, but he's not just leaning on the movement. He is upping the ante with the other elements of his game. And with someone who moves so well, it is so easy to just kind of play to your strengths and lean on that movement. There's going to be enough against so many players. But if you really want to be up there, there has to be development. And we've seen that from him over the past 12 months. I think the fact that he's even managed to take form from hard courts to clay courts is just the biggest underlining of that fact. I think his first serve percentages in terms of number of those shots landed has been a little bit low in some of his matches across the course of this tournament, which is something that Zverev could take advantage of for sure. And then you've got that head-to-head, and I'm struggling here, Gil, to kind of articulate why I feel the way I feel about Zverev. But I've been watching this guy for, when did I first see him? It's the best part of a decade
17.
Now.
17? I mean, yeah, 17.
And he's my age. He's the same age as me. So I've okay. kind of like watched him. I remember watching him like live when he was kind of mid late teens. And this is what I'm going to bring it to. Okay. Like 2 years ago, Misha Zverev, Alex's brother, Sasha, whatever you want to call him. Like his brother is a broadcaster now. He works for Eurosport. And 2 years ago at Roland Garros, he predicted Zverev to win the title. And I remember that and laughing, literally laughing out loud, thinking like the biggest display of bias I've ever seen in my life. And then Zverev played that incredible quality half match against Nadal, which he left in a wheelchair. And all I could think of was Misha Zverev picking him to win the title. And that massive what if as he got wheeled away as to whether he, you know, if for me there he was not. Sometimes the people closest to know things that other people don't. And I just, mm-hmm. I think Zverev, with everything he's achieved and the self-confidence, the belief that he is that goes such a long way. So I, having steered his way past Holger Rune, having got the win over Nadal in the first round, for me, coming in, the only question was, can he hit through the court at championship point? Because he was kind of second to Alcaraz for me in terms of contenders to win the title. And I don't know that I ever saw him winning a Grand Slam after the initial early years of the big four will move away and he will have his opportunity. I would still be concerned about him and that passiveness,
mm-hmm.
semis, final. I'm not concerned about it here. I think he wins this match.
I'm with you. Yeah, it's the nerve management for me. That's always just the thing I can't get past. And when he's playing his best tennis and everybody goes like, wow, that's the level that wins majors. I nod my head and I say, yes, it is. Yes, okay. It is. It does not mean he's going to win one, and we'll see. Maybe he will, maybe he won't. But doing it at a Masters 1000 and doing it at a Slam has always been different. I agree with you. This is the quarterfinals, and he will feel comfortable and confident, I believe, coming in as long as his body holds up. He is a durability monster. Like, I do think that he is really, really good at playing these long matches and holding up. Is he going to cross the line at some point here? Because this is probably going to be a physical match also. I think it's trending that way, unfortunately for him. But I'm with you. I think Zverev is too comfortable here with the serve. And even the way the backhand works on clay, the spinnier forehand, I think he has a chance to overpower Demonor in a way that Medvedev could not. And on top of that, I don't think he's ever minded grinding with Demonor. If shot tolerance, consistency. It's almost like the way I look at the matchup. They're even from the back. And then Zverev is like, that serve is going to just push me that 5% that I need to be the better player in this match.
And his serve was foundational, I think, in the win against Rune. That serve held up for him during the five sets. When it really needed to, it was there. And we've seen that from him over other Grand Slams. I remember his match against Norrie at the Australian Open. I think that serve was the biggest differentiating factor ultimately between the two.
He made first serves. He faced 10 break points, and he went 10 for 10 on first serves.
There you go. So again, it's that clutchness with the serve and the knowledge that he has that as a weapon, where his forthcoming opponent does not have it to the same level. And I don't know if you call it arrogance, but there is just this drastic self-confidence about Zverev, where he walks into this match expecting to win it, and he can back himself to do that. And so can his brother, apparently. So,
that's good. You want your brother in your corner. Then against some opponents at the end of slams, then maybe he gets a little insecure.
Sure, like because bubble, he crosses a line confidence. At that point.
Right.
Because it becomes real at that point. You know, that's when it's right in front of you. That's when it's tangible. That's when you can touch it.
Right.
And then he does crumble, I think is a fair word.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not there yet. We're at the quarterfinals.
We're at the quarterfinals. You sound like Nadal when he arrives in Rome.
What happened in third round happened, and what happened in fourth round happened. And now here we are.
Here we are. All right. Get some rest. Enjoy. Oh, one more question.
Oh, yeah.
Who are you most looking forward to watching, commentating in Surbiton this week, and why?
Do you know what? Oh, Gil, I was going to tell you this. Guess who's on my order of play? By the way, everybody, it's 10 past 2 in the morning, and we've got a lovely four-match day coming up, which, don't feel bad, Gil, I'm actually pumped about this. But guess who's on the order of play? Mr. João Fonseca of Brazil.
Wow. I don't think there's any commentator in the world who's called more Fonseca matches than you at this point.
I know, right? I think the kid is going to think I'm stalking him. I called the first match of his when he played actually Wimbledon Juniors last year, and he lost to one of our Brits, Henry Searle, who then went and won the whole tournament. So that's not a bad loss for him at all. But no, I've been very privileged to have a very kind of front row seat for his progression on the pro circuit over the course of this year. If you can give me a moment, he's playing Kyle Edmund,
whoa,
he former semi-finalist at the Australian Open fame, and came through qualifying here in Surbiton. Surbiton's such a great draw every single year. It will happen next year. It's moving to Birmingham. But, you know, with it being second week of Roland Garros, it's in London. So you either hop on the Eurostar, the train, or you get a quick flight in. And so popular for the players to get an early start on the grass court season, which is already so small. You get several top 100 players competing in both the challenger draw and the ITF draw, the women's draw, which I'm also commentating. I'm doing all the center court matches this week. So yeah, you can tune in on ATP Challenger TV, LTA YouTube channel if they're in the UK. And it's, yeah, just phenomenal draws. A lot of exciting matches, but we do love a bit of João Fonseca.
I'm into that. Fonseca Edmund is a great choice. That's popcorn material. Get some rest. Thank you so much for coming on, especially given the hours.
You're welcome.
Which we have Alexander Zverev and Holger Rune to blame, but I really appreciate it.
No, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.